All right, Graham, welcome to the Aspiring Pilot Podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, very welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, cheers. All right, this is kind of where we start with everyone. We're just kind of going to ask you first, how are you introduced to aviation? Did you have like a family member employed through an airline or something like that? Or you just always been obsessed with airplanes? Like, what kind of drew you to aviation?
I was kind of obsessed with airplanes to begin with, but that's because my dad was a pilot and my mom was a flight attendant. So my dad, he was a pilot for an airline called Time Air, and they turned into Canadian Regional and then became Jazz. And then he retired from there 8 years ago. And my mom was a flight attendant for Time Air. So that's where they met. And then she left Jazz about in 2005 when they closed the Victoria base. So I was kind of doomed from the start, as they say.
Yeah, for sure. Was that just due to the, like, seeing your dad come home from work every day and just put the pilot cap on? Or did you get it like a moment there? Was there like kind of realization like, oh, this is what I want to do? Like, I want to fly airplanes or anything like that throughout your childhood?
I think it was that too. Just always like being exposed to it. Plus, we had a family friend that had an airstrip that we would go to as a kid. So I remember going up there to see the planes, and my dad always, he would take me out to the flying club too for lunch. So I was kind of always exposed to them. They were kind of always around in a way. So
Yeah, sure.
I guess that's where my interest probably sparked from.
Okay. Was your dad like involved in like general aviation while you were young? Like, did you go flying in like small airplanes, or was it just kind of like seeing them flying around and then one day you decided, okay, I should probably like go into Discovery Flight?
It was actually he never did general aviation once he was at the airlines, but so it's just seeing them flying around. But in grade six, I got like some decent grades. So we were at the flying club having lunch, and then he surprised me with a Discovery Flight. So I was 12 years old when I first got to fly an airplane, and I think that kind of set the, you know, the kind of set it in stone for me. That's what I wanted to do. But kind of a funny thing about that, with how small the industry is, that the instructor that took me up flying when I was 12, later on when I got hired as a rampy at Sunwest in Calgary, I moved in with one of the cargo pilots there, and turns out that was the instructor. So like 8 years later, after flying on this Discovery Flight, I was living with him in Calgary starting my first job. So.
Yeah, no way. What are the odds of that, hey?
It's quite a small world.
100%. That's awesome. Yeah. So that's the moment, you think, that kind of like kickstarted your aviation career, just taking that Discovery Flight, and then that's when you decided like, this is something I want to do? Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I kind of flipped between that and was interested in other jobs. Like, I wanted to be a marine architect at one point, which is the a ship builder or a doctor, but I always kept coming back to flying. So I figured, you know, that's kind of a nice career. And, you know, my dad always enjoyed it, and my uncle's a pilot too, and he enjoyed it. So I always like being up in the air. So and I still like it. So
yeah,
100%. That's the path I decided to go down.
Nice. Okay. Do you think there's something about aviation that kind of made you decide to go down that route instead of the other careers you're considering? Like some standout part of the job, or just aviation in general?
Yeah, I think just the general aviation interest, but I think a big part too is I don't think I could do like the 9-to-5 sort of thing. I like being like out and seeing the world, and it's kind of nice in this job because even though I do a lot of domestic flying, it's, you're still leaving your town and you get to see so many parts of the country that you wouldn't normally get to see.
Yep.
And it's and you're working different kind of hours and everything. It's not like a consistent thing, like a 9-to-5. So I think I would kind of go crazy if I was in a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
So not really built for that, I guess. But
I think
9-to-5 job, but
yeah, true. Yeah. I think a lot of people think the same way. That's another thing that's like drawn me into aviation, kind of made me want to pursue like a career in it. I like that idea too, of not having the same set schedule nonstop, just like clocking in, clock out. Like, it's different, it kind of rotates around, and you got so many different places you can take it, right? You can go anywhere and do tons of different jobs. So yeah, I think that's a really common answer for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of funny too. One of the things that, you know, if like someone just brought up to me, like I was in like 4 cities in one day, but I think nothing of it because it's just normal to me now. But people, you know, they, you know, we'll travel maybe once a year, if that. And
yeah,
but it's just, for us, it's like normal to like be like, oh, I was in Halifax and Toronto this morning and now I'm here. So it's kind of, you just kind of, it's kind of funny in that way. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's like a thing as a kid that like fascinated me and drew me into it was that I always like every time me and my family go on vacation, my favorite part was always the plane ride every time, like the flight. I was more excited about hopping on the airplane than actually getting to the destination. If we were going to Mexico, I was just stoked, like so electric to get on the airplane because I thought it was fascinating that we could just like go across the continent in a couple of hours, but driving would take like 2 days. I thought that was like the coolest thing in the world. So yeah, no, I agree with you there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the same thing too. That was the big thing I looked forward to on any trip was the plane ride.
Yeah.
And especially like when I was really young, it was before 9/11 too. And I remember going to Hawaii on a DC-10 when I was maybe 6 years old and we got to go up front and see the flight deck. And I remember just being awe of it over this big room and seeing the clouds all down below.
Yeah.
That was pretty neat.
That's super cool. Yeah. I wish I'd got an experience like that. I never got that. A lot of people I talked to, I know Luke had a similar experience in a 747. He told me that too. That was kind of his like awe moment. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's awesome. Like, this is what I want to do. So awesome. Good stuff. Can you take me through your like your pathway after that Discovery flight? Did you like immediately as like at a young age hop in and go after your PPL? Or was that kind of later, like down the line after university or something like that?
I pretty much, as soon as I turned 17, I went into it. The summer before, I worked at a company called CanWest that did the ground services at the Victoria Airport for WestJet and Horizon Air. So I was 16 working the ramp there to make enough money for my private license. Then pretty much a month right after I turned 17, I started my private license at Pacific Sky Aviation. They were formerly called WAN Air, but they had just changed their name then. And yeah, I worked there. I also worked at the flight school too while I was doing my private license. So I started that in 2008 and then, got my private license there and washed airplanes there as well to help pay for the license too. And then, Pacific Sky Aviation closed down to, at the time they wanted to close their general flight school there is my understanding. And then just do training for people coming overseas to put on the Twin Otter. So I think they wanted to train them from the ground up is what I was told, at least back then. So I ended up going to the Victoria Flying Club and then I went to the Flying Club and built up more hours and did my commercial at the Victoria Flying Club. And then, once I got my, commercial flight test done, I went to a small flight school called Compass West Aviation that was, run by an Air Canada pilot named Russ Ballman, and he had two Beech Barons that he was just doing multi-IFRs on. So,
oh, cool.
I did my multi-IFR there. Yeah, and the Baron was a really cool airplane too. It was the one I flew was built in 1964, and you know, it didn't have alternators, it had generators. So you had to tax around at like 1100 RPM to generate enough electricity to keep her going.
Yeah, that's but awesome.
It just had this nice rumble okay. to it. I finished my multi-IFR and right when I turned 19 and then at that time too I had now gotten a job at the Shell Aero Center in Victoria, so I've been working there since I was 18 and once I finished all my licenses I sent resumes out to every air operator I could think of and then one day at the FBO there was the chief pilot for cargo at Sunwest Aviation was doing training on the metro there. So I popped in and chatted with him for a bit, gave him my resume, and he forwarded it to the Sunwest recruitment department in Calgary and then got a phone call for them and an interview on the phone. And then next thing I knew, I was 19 years old in December, moving from Victoria to Calgary to start a ramp job. So that was the start of the career there.
Nice. Yeah. Do you want to tell me like how long after that you were at that ramp position? Cause I think if I remember correctly, you were telling me you had to, you put some years on the ramp before you actually landed that, first officer position.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really lucky that I was on the ramp for, 8 months. They quoted me, I think it was at least a year is what they said. And at the time, Air Tindy, for example, I remember hearing it was 3 years on the ramp up in Yellowknife. So
okay, there we go. I think we're all set again. All right. Sweet. Yeah. So if you just want to continue on for what you're saying with Sunwest, I asked you how many years you had to put on the ramp there going in, because I remember last time I talked to you, you said there was a little bit of time in between your hiring date with Sunwest and then your first day as the first officer. So if you just want to touch on that, that'd be good.
Sure. Yeah. When they hired me on the ramp, I guess a bit of a background for the ramp thing there too, is that they would put pilots on the ramp that had less than 1,000 hours, and you're waiting in line to become a first officer on a Piper Navajo. And we used to use the Piper Navajos for bank bag runs up to the small towns in Alberta. And so they quoted me initially when I started there about at least a year on the ramp in waiting. And then when positions came available as the current ramp Navajo FOs moved on to bigger airplanes, you know, they would take us from full-time ramp and put us on the Navajo. So I was very, very fortunate that I only spent 8 months full-time on the ramp. And then they took a few of us rampies when some positions came available on the Navajo, and we did an interview with the chief pilot for cargo and the HR recruiter. And then we went to the simulator at Mount Royal University and did a sim eval there. And then and I think they selected two of us at the time, so, and I was one of them. So after 8 months, I got selected to go on the Navajo. And the position was, it was part-time flying. So you're flying the Navajo two or three times a week, and you're working the ramp the other days of the week. So like, say, 1 week I would fly Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then I would work the ramp Tuesday, Thursday, and then the following week it would switch, be on the ramp Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and fly Tuesday, Thursday. So, I got on the Navajo and started flying the Navajo, and I did that Navajo / ramp position for, I think, about a year and a half. And then I got enough hours after doing that, and then did another interview in a sim eval, and ended up going FO on the Metro 23. So, yeah, it was a bit of a while, but yeah,
it takes a while. But I guess it was a different time back then too. Do you want to touch on that? Like the difference between when you were kind of coming up and looking for that first officer position compared to what the experience might be like today for someone coming up? Because I know there's a little bit easier, it seems like, for pilots looking to get into it today than back when you were getting into it.
Yeah, it seemed like back then you either had to stay in the flight school and do your instructor rating and instruct to build your hours, and then you could move on, because like airlines, like back then, like Jazz, they wouldn't really look at you unless you had a few thousand hours under your belt, and unless you were the top, I think, one or two graduates from a couple of the aviation colleges such as Mount Royal. But other than that, they wouldn't even look at you unless you had a few thousand hours. So and Air Canada was even beyond that too, same with WestJet and all that. And but I remember the rule we were told, or the guidelines we were told at SunWest, was that if you had less than 1,000 hours, you were on the ramp and when you become an Navajo FO. And I think that was kind of a general thing, not many guys, it seemed like, went straight into a flying position. You either had to do flight instruction or work the ramp. And the whole point of working the ramp was to, you go to these charter companies and you sort of pay your dues in a way, because you don't have any flight time. So they don't want to put you directly on an airplane. So they kind of want to see, how hard you work and, if you're, worthy in a way to, be promoted to the flight line. So, and our ramp was, it was pretty good. It was definitely a lot better than a lot of companies I hear. We were living in a big city, which is a huge bonus. And although my initial shift was 2:30 in the morning to 11 in the morning, we still had a very strong safety culture. They didn't make you stand on wings and mop them. We had a proper de-ice truck and you would clean hangar floors and windows and also load the, help pilots load the bags on airplanes and tow the airplanes around, refuel them. It was quite the operation we had back then.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. How was the flying with the Navajo and stuff? I find that pretty interesting. So you were flying into like remote Albertan cities and stuff, like smaller towns?
Yeah, we were. There's three Navajo runs. One would go to Cranbrook with bank bags on board. And bank bags were just literally duffel bags filled with, I think, canceled checks and paper that there was no legal electronic form for. They had to be in the physical paper form. So we would fly these bank bags. One would go to Cranbrook, but they usually went single pilot. So a Navajo captain would fly it there. But the FOs, we would do, there was two northern runs. The first run was Calgary to Edson to Grand Prairie, then to Peace River. And then we'd spend the, about 6 hours or so in Peace River. And they had a crew house, it's called, which was like an apartment building there too, where they rented an apartment with beds so you could sleep. And and rest during the day. And they provided a car as well for us, so we could get from the airport to the crew house and get food. And then, you know, we spent about 6 hours a day there. And then we would fly back along the same route. And then the second Navajo route was Calgary to Vermilion, and then Athabasca, then Slave Lake. And then we would spend about the same amount of time in Slave Lake and then work our way back. So we'd drop off bank bags on the way up there. And then on the way back south, we would pick up bank bags to take to the hub in Calgary. So I think our full day was about maybe 17 hours. So kind of a long one, but good time builder. We built about 5 or 6 hours each day. So yeah, not too bad.
Yeah, that's really on multi-engine. Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. I know a lot of people, especially waking up at 2:30 in the morning, might rethink what they're doing with aviation. Were you just motivated all the way through, or was there a moment where you kind of thought like, am I in the right thing? Or were they kind of like, I guess, updating you guys too on what your position was and how soon you might get into that first officer position, or are you just like 1,000 hours and then we'll talk?
We were kind of, you never kind of knew, you know, when you would get promoted next. Like when you're a full-time ramp, you're kind of just you're waiting for the current Navajo FOs to move on. So, you know, there's always the ramp rumors going around, you know, someone always has heard something, and, you know, they're saying, oh, there's a Navajo spot coming up soon. And we all get excited. And then, you know, maybe there isn't, or then maybe there's two or three of them. And then, you know, all the rumors spill who's going to get the spot and who's not, and, you know, kind of get that excitement. But there definitely was some discouragement, you know, like you're working in minus 30, minus 20, and it's so early in the morning and you don't know how long it's going to take. You know, you don't, sometimes you just don't really see the light at the end of the tunnel, but, you know, you just got to remind yourself, you know, where do you want to be in 5 years, for, you know, or even 1 year, 2 years, you know, if you quit now, you know, you're starting at square one or changing careers or something, right? There were guys that did quit, and you know, they, you know, ended up a few years behind, you know, or quit aviation altogether. So I just kind of, you know, tried to grin and bear it and stick through it, and it worked out in the end, you know. And it goes by relatively fast anyways. When you're in the thick of it, it seems to be dragging on, and, you know, you're just hoping to that spot will come soon. But once you're actually flying, like when I was flying the Navajo and working the ramp part-time, I didn't mind working the ramp so much because I was actually flying and now building time and, you know, and learning lots as well. And it just kind of became just trying to build enough flight hours to move on to a turboprop, because that was the next step that Sunless would do, is then once you were, you built up enough time on the Navajo and you did a good enough job, they would promote you to a first officer on maybe a King Air or a Beech 1900 or a Metro. And then you would be full-time flight line, so you'd be totally done with the ramp.
Nice. Yeah. Well, how was that? Do you want to describe that moment when you found out that like you had reached the light at the end of the tunnel and you're finally going to get on that right seat?
Yeah, it was super exciting. I actually remember it well, too, because I remember doing the sim eval and I thought, you know, I screwed it all up, you know, like we all do. We're all rusty, right? And you sit on the ramp, you're not flying for so long, but they're not looking for perfection. At least they want to see, you know, if you're teachable and, you know, if you know your basics and all that. But I was at my house and I had, you know, a couple of roommates that were Metro captains for Sunwest. And then the chief up for cargo gave me the phone call and he just told me, yep, you're going on the Navajo. And that was a big, big relief, you know, finally, you know, like going to start flying an airplane and, you know, doing what I'm here to do. And yeah. And I think that was, October of 2011 when I finally got that. So that was when I finally got, I guess, trained up, I think it was. So yeah, that was a huge, huge moment. Very exciting.
Nice. Okay. After Sunwest, like, how much time did you spend there, I guess? And then how was that experience? And then when did you move on to Jazz? I believe that was your next stop, if I'm not wrong, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I spent about 5 years at Sunwest. So once I got on the Metro 23 as a first officer, I flew that for about a year as a first officer. Maybe a little over a year as a first officer, and then built up flight time that way. And we were doing mostly cargo as well, bank bags, and also doing crew changes up to the oil sands up in like Fort McMurray sometimes, but mostly Fort Nelson, Fort St. John, and for gas workers. And then I went captain on the Metro 2, which was the older variant of the Metro. It's the sketchiest version. It's the one where that gives the Metro the bad reputation for making you deaf and all that. And we'd use that for just purely UPS cargo flying and sometimes rescues. And like if a, you know, a plane went mechanical, we'd fly a mechanic there and they'd take care of it and, or fill in for some of the bank bag runs. But yeah, I built my command hours on the Metro 2 for a while. Then once I got my airline transport license, I went captain of the Metro 23 and flew that doing passenger charters and cargo as well. We were also doing some more passenger charters with it, like to Masset and the Queen Charlottes for fishing charters. We would do that direct from Calgary and or Red Deer sometimes. And then, yeah, then I think I had probably around 3,000 hours, maybe, yeah, just shy of 3,000 hours. And I applied at Jazz and then did an interview and a sim eval at Jazz and got hired there onto the Dash 8-100 and Dash 8-300.
Nice, yeah. Just to jump back quickly, something I'm interested in, what kind of emotion were you experiencing on that first like charter flight with passengers? Because you were starting with cargo, right? So nobody else was on board. As a commercial pilot and stuff, like when you had to hire, were you super nervous that first time, like having people on board, or what was that experience like?
Yeah, it's a bit nerve-wracking. Yeah, because especially on the Metro 23, there's no flight deck door. So you have 19 people staring at you, and or at least the back of your head, and they kind of, you know, see what's going on. But and the Metro is not the greatest airplane to land either. So, you know, you got all that extra pressure. It was definitely nerve-wracking, and they make you dress up too. You had to wear your white shirt and tie and all that. And when we flew cargo, we just wore flight suits. So that was a lot more casual. But yeah, it was definitely quite nerve-wracking. But yeah, it went well. I think actually my first passenger flight was an oil sands tour. So it was kind of a really random, weird, not weird, but a really random kind of special flight where we had 19 people, including one tour guide on there. And they had this sound system with headphones all built into the, or wired into the airplane so that they could, so the tour guide could speak to all the passengers. And then we took off from Edmonton and did a nice low tour over the different oil sand sites, and the tour guide explained to the passengers, you know, which site we're at, whether we're at the Shell site or I think Husky or, and all that. And I think we did that for maybe 2 hours of flying before dropping them off in Edmonton. So it was kind of a neat, unique, first flight, you know, with passengers on board. It wasn't just a normal, crew change or something.
Yeah, for sure. A little bit different than, a standard one for sure. Awesome. I guess what was your first like couple weeks at Jazz like? Was that like a huge moment for you, I imagine? Just like saying that you were for Jazz, it must be a pretty cool feeling. So can you touch on that?
Yeah, it was a really cool feeling. The training was pretty good. Jazz had a fantastic training department, and when you started your ground school, you literally just drew your seniority number out of a hat, because that airline's everything's seniority. So they put your names in a hat and you literally drew your name out of a hat. And I think I picked near the bottom, but I ended up getting Toronto based on the Dash 8 100 and 300. And I was still living in Calgary at the time. So I was thinking I might have to commute. So that was a bit of a worry that, you know, I'm based so far from home. But I was very fortunate enough that by the time they finally trained me up on the Dash 8 and I was doing my light indoctrination on it, that I was now switched to Calgary base. So I never ended up having to commute. But yeah, the training was very good, very, very solid. We did online ground school on the airplane after we did our company course when we first started. And then we went to the simulator in Vancouver, and yeah, they trained us up real good on that. And then I believe my first day at Jazz, you know, the thing is with the airlines, and when you're training in a level D simulator, the first time you fly the actual airplane is a regular sked flight with passengers on board. So the first time I ever flew a Dash 8 was Calgary to Grand Prairie, and we had a full load of people, and it was a Dash 8 300. So that was kind of a neat first day. We did Calgary, Grand Prairie, back to Calgary. And then I think we did... we went to Kamloops for the night, I believe. And then the second day I saw Castlegar. And I think on the third day I saw Nanaimo. So Castlegar is a bit intimidating to see on your like first or second day. You're just brand new on the plane. It's a very mountainous airport. And as I'm sure you know,
no kidding.
Yeah. But it's cool. On a nice day, it was one of my favorites.
Yeah. This might be a silly question, but for someone who has like no idea what that's like, like showing up on your first day, do you know exactly what's going on, like where to go and stuff when you're showing up to like the international airport, or do you know who you're working with, or how does that work through Jazz or just airlines in general, I guess?
Yeah, if it's your first day, you're with a training captain, and they'll call you before and tell you, you know, hey, this is where we'll meet, and you'll usually just meet in the crew room, where each hub has a crew room for the crews to meet and hang out and check for flight plans and whatnot. So yeah, we just met there, and then you already know the airplane well enough. It's just now learning the line flying part. So they call you beforehand, ask you if you have any questions, and then the day of, you meet at where you decided to meet up, and then you go over a couple things, and then you literally just walk to the airplane, and he'll show you the walk around, a couple things that maybe you didn't really do in the simulator, and you get there early, of course, to give yourself lots of time, and because it is different than the simulator, and then you just take your time, and you're not so much worried about delaying the flight. It's about doing things right and not trying to rush, especially when you're brand new. And you just take your time, and they're very well trained, and they're very good at guiding you through your line indoctrination, as it's called, and showing you the ropes. But the simulator does a pretty good job for preparing you for that. It's just the only funny thing is in the simulator you're doing emergencies all the time, right? So when you're flying the actual airplane for the first time, you're doing your first takeoff, you're just totally thinking something wrong is going to happen. You think you're going to lose an engine or something, because that's every takeoff you did in the simulator, but then nothing happens. So it's kind of a strange feeling that you're flying this airplane and nothing's going wrong, like in the simulator when you're training. So that was a bit of a funny feeling in a way, but it's a bit more, relaxing in a way too, because now you're doing longer flights. So you're able to look at the window and discuss things. And then you're now doing what you're wanting to do the whole time. So it's a relief, really, once you get to that point.
Yeah, for sure. Was there a moment on that first flight when you kind of like got up there and you're cruising that you're just like, wow, this is where I've wanted to get to?
Yeah, it was a big moment. Yeah, just kind of, it's kind of a relief, thinking, I finally made it. My goal is always the airlines, and now I was flying an airliner, and it was pretty neat too, because it was, my dad used to fly the Dash 8s for Jazz as well. So I was flying literally the exact same airplane my dad flew, and that my mom worked on as a flight attendant, that my uncle, he flew the Dash 8s as well. He flew. So it's kind of neat. It's like finally, family moment in a way where we've all flown now the same airplane. So yeah, that was pretty neat. Yeah.
That is really cool. Awesome. Through your time throughout Jazz, was there like a, can you think back and think of a flight that was like the most memorable by far, or something interesting happened or something like that?
I had a depressurization. It was not a rapid depressurization, but this is when I went captain on the Q400. So after about a year and a half, I was NFO on the classic Dash 8, as they call it. And then I got upgraded to captain on the Q400. So, but there was one day when I was flying that airplane, and we were flying from Calgary to Kelowna, and we just level off at 24,000 feet in cruise, and then we get the master warning go off, and it says cabin pressure. So we look up, and the cabin's climbing 1,000 feet per minute, and so it's not explosive, it's not rapid, it's just subtle decompression. So, but the first thing you do is you put your oxygen mask on. So we put the oxygen mask on, and my first officer, he did the same too, and then we established communications, and turns out his microphone wasn't working in his mask, and that's no problem, that's fine. So his duties are a silent read and do of the QRH, the quick reference handbook checklist, and I took over ATC communications, told ADC we have a have an issue with cabin pressure, we're going to need to descend and head back to Calgary, and so that's what we did. We just kind of ran the drills and informed the flight attendants, passengers, and returned to Calgary. Had an uneventful landing there, and then swapped airplanes, and after debriefing with the crew, and off we went. But that was kind of my first really only major issue I had with an airliner, at least, and it wasn't even that really big of a deal. An airplane can fly unpressurized. The only concerning thing is you're over the mountains, but that's why we have minimum altitudes and such, and all these procedures to follow. But it was the need to, in the end, when you look back, it's the neat experience, right? See how you perform and all that. And everybody did a great job, flight attendants, the FO, and so it all worked out well. But yeah, so that was, I guess, the memorable not quite emergency, but, you know, mechanical issue I've had at Jazz. But on a positive side, too, you know, I had a it was a privilege to fly with a lot of pilots that my my parents worked with. And that my dad flew with a lot of these pilots, these captains I flew with on the Classic Dash 8. They were my dad's first officers, and so it was really, really neat to you know, fly with these people I've heard so much about over my whole life, and flight attendants too. There was right when I got captain on the Q400, I was flying with a flight attendant, and she was an old family friend of my parents. I've known her my whole life, and she told me that she was at my baby shower before I was even born, and now I'm her captain. So, so I'm just like, I'm sorry.
But, so funny. Aviation is super sweet. Well, sure. That's awesome.
It is. Yeah. And it felt like a family, you know, at Jazz. That's what I really miss about Jazz. It just felt like a nice family like that. You know, everybody kind of knows everybody, and it was a friendly, great place to work back then too.
Yeah. That's awesome. I guess upgrading to a captain, was there a moment where you kind of felt like a little bit more pressure? I guess from me not going through that and stuff, I feel like jumping from a first officer to the captain must feel like you're kind of throwing a lot more on your back. Did it, did you experience that? Is that kind of how you felt, or how did that experience go?
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge for sure, because, you know, when you're a first officer, you know, you still fly the airplane and talk on the radio, do pretty much the same duties as the captain does. But when you're the captain, you're overall in charge of the operation and responsible for what's going on. So the kind of the pressure you feel too is you're the captain now, and everybody's looking at you for the answers for things. So if something goes wrong, or even when things go right, you know, everybody's kind of looking at you to run the show. So it's a bit of that pressure, you know, and it could be anything that random turns up, you know, a disgruntled passenger or you know, a mechanical issue with the airplane, or weather, where you have to make a decision, you know, if we're going to divert or not, and all the pressure's kind of on you. And of course you want to do the best job that you can and, you know, keep everybody happy. But sometimes you have to make an unpopular decision, like, you know, delaying a flight because of, you know, a weather issue or something like that, or just because you got to, you know, double check on something and, you know, make sure everything, all the, you know, T's are crossed and I's are dotted and whatnot. But the nice thing about being a captain, though, is you're the one that sets the tone. You kind of run the show the way you want to run it. When you're first officer, you're kind of like a chameleon in a way. You all this, you know, you're flying the airplane, like I said, and all that. But you kind of have to adjust the way the captain does things. So you'll fly with maybe someone who's very strict on the SOPs, you know, to the letter one day. And then the next day you're flying with a guy who's a bit more lax, or one guy wants to, you know, he has certain techniques or methods to do something, and, you know, than a different guy, and, you know, you kind of have to go with the flow there a little bit. But usually captains will just let you fly the airplane the way you want to fly the airplane, and that's always good. And but yeah, when you're the captain, you just run the show, so it's a little bit less stressful in that, not, I shouldn't say stressful, but it's just a little bit more easier in that sense. You know, you just do your thing and everybody follows you, so it's not that bad.
Yeah, no, for sure, that's awesome. I guess from there, then, after spending your time as a captain on the Q400, is there like a day when Air Canada kind of gets in touch with you and sees if you want to come on board with them, or how does that process go? Is it like an application you send in? Are those two companies, I know they're separate entities, do they communicate a lot and kind of push pilots forward? Or if you want to touch on that, that'd be really great.
Sure. Yeah, Jazz had... I think it's a little bit different now, but back then they had a pilot mobility list, it was called. And you could go on the Air Canada recruiting website and you could check a box that if you're Express, and I believe on our company bid page too for positions and stuff, you could click a box too that says you want to be on that pilot mobility list. So I clicked the box and uploaded my resume and cover letter with Air Canada. And Air Canada kind of changes their hiring preferences, you know, with the wind, it seems sometimes. So you never really know when you're going to get on. Like back then, it wasn't just based on seniority. They were trying to hire a certain amount from Jazz for a while, but then they had to hire from other people as well, because, you know, you take too many guys from Jazz. Now Jazz is having a hard time trying to fill their positions, and it, you know, it's strains their training department a bit. So I sent my resume in and all that, and then clicked a link to do an online interview, which is just a link that pops up on your iPad and with some app, and a question appears, and then the camera turns on. You just answer the question as best as you can. There's nobody interviewing you. You're just video recording yourself answering questions, which was quite awkward, you know, because you're just talking to yourself.
And then
that goes in, and then I didn't hear anything for a while, and you know, I was starting to kind of wonder what's going on. You know, I figure, well, if I failed it, you know, you usually when you hear something right away, it's not a good thing. And I didn't, so I didn't, so I knew, you know, things were probably okay, but you know, it's a bit, you know, a little bit, it's always in the back of your mind wondering, like, am I going, when am I going? Because you keep hearing things like, oh, they're hiring mostly guys from Encore now or something like this, and not as many jazz guys. And then at the time they were wanting to hire pilots that had degrees, and then aviation college and the rest of us. And I didn't have a degree or aviation college. So there's some people below me on seniority at jazz that were going ahead of me. So you just kind of have to kind of just go with the flow there and just wait for the phone call. And I think about 10 months had passed since I did the online interview. And then I was literally 3 days before going on a trip to Greece with a buddy. And I got an email saying, congratulations, you passed the video interview. We'd like to invite you for an in-person interview. So I quickly like called them back and tried to set it up, because, you know, I was leaving in like 3 days. And I was lucky to schedule the interview in Toronto for a week after I got back from Greece. So, and the interview process there is quite rigorous. They, in the morning, I showed up to do a full medical with their doctors. They have their own medical department. So I, they do like a full physical, and they take a blood sample from you, and they just, you know, lung capacity tests, eye tests. They do, just a lot of tests on you to make sure, you know, you're all fit and whatnot. And then after that, went and did the in-person interview with a member of HR and one of the A320 captains there. And, finish the interview, and then they do this online psych test. So it's about, I think it's like 300 or 350 true or false questions, and you know, they ask you kind of weird things, and I think they're just looking for patterns and all that too. Like they ask you, you know, if you've would you rather write a poem or clean your gun, or if they have you ever smoked a cigarette, stuff like that, like really random things. I'm not sure how it works, but it's kind of a weird thing. And then, so there's those three steps then it's a waiting game after that. And then, yeah, then can't remember how long, maybe a month or so after that passed and didn't hear anything. And then I just got a phone call from them. And when I was having breakfast one morning, and they asked me if I'd like to work there, and said, sure. And they set me up with a course date in January of 2019. And, and then that's where I'm at now. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. So you got on with flying the Airbus, right? Do you want to touch on how the simulation trip for that and the training process for that? I think that'd be really interesting to hear.
Sure. Yeah. So I left Jazz and then started at Air Canada and what's called a pilot indoctrination training course, like PIT course. And that's where they, your whole ground school, or I think there was about 30 of us or so in the ground school. They teach us the company stuff and some CRM stuff, and kind of, you know, introduce us to the company, and then we draw our seniority numbers out of a hat, just like we did at Jazz. And I pick near the bottom again, and then they give us a list of airplanes and positions, like bases and types that are available to us. There's some Rouge 767 first officer spots, a bunch of Toronto A320 spots, some Vancouver and Toronto 737 FO spots, and relief pilot on the 777, the 87 in Vancouver and Toronto, and some Embraer 190 FO spots in Toronto. And so then we just write on a form. I think there's like five choices you can make or something like that, like your number one choice, two choice, and then submit those. And then you have to wait all weekend. And then finally on like the Monday or the Tuesday, it's a 2 week course. So on the second week, I think it was like a Monday or a Tuesday, then they put on the screen, you know, the position assignments. And I was fortunate enough to get the A320. Unfortunately, I was based in Toronto. I was hoping for Vancouver because I was living in Calgary, but Air Canada doesn't have a Calgary base, so Vancouver would have been the closest base to where I lived. And but got Toronto base, got the airplane I wanted, and so I ended up training on that. And the training was pretty rigorous. It's definitely a jump going from a Dash 8 to an Airbus. It's the Airbus is a totally different way of thinking. Not only just bigger, but it's just like the kind of the level of automation in it. Like it's still 1980s technology, but like you got managed modes, it's called, where the airplane will, with the auto thrust, will, if you leave it in managed, and there's a speed restriction program, it'll automatically slow itself down for that, or speed up. And then same with descents, you know, if you're doing an arrival and there's certain crossing restrictions for altitude and speeds, if you leave it in managed mode, it'll usually make those. Sometimes you have to intervene with spoilers or, you know, something, but just trying to wrap my head around, you know, that sort of thing, and then the jet stuff. But so it was quite a challenge. It was a very challenging course, but yeah, I made it through, and then started my line and dock. First flight was flying a 320 down to Phoenix from Vancouver. So new airport and new airplane, and yeah, that was pretty cool. Overnighted there, then flew an A319 back to Vancouver. So at Air Canada, when you're trained on the A320, it also means the A319 and the A321. It's a common type. So they just got very subtle differences, mostly performance. But yeah, so did my line and dock, and ended up commuting from Calgary to Toronto for, I think it was just 4 months, luckily. And then I got Vancouver based, and then commuted from Calgary to Vancouver for like a year and a half or so. And then I moved back to Victoria about 2.5 years ago. So now it's just an easy commute from Victoria to Vancouver, whether it's by ferry or Jazz or Pacific Coastal. So it's, yeah, it's not too bad. So got where I wanted to be. Nice. So yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I guess, is that, I know obviously like the position you're at right now, like so many people would absolutely like die to be where you're at, and that's like a dream position for so many people. Do you have aspirations of doing anything different in the future? Any like different equipment you want to work on, or is that kind of like your dream goal and that's where you want to be?
Yeah, it's pretty much the dream goal, right? I've always wanted to be, I've always wanted to fly for Air Canada. That was always the end goal. So now it's just, the next step would be, going captain. So, I can hold it now in Montreal and Toronto, but I don't want to move there, and, you know, it's a far commute. So I'm going to hold out for a position in Vancouver. But the thing is that airlines, everything's based on seniority. So whether it's your days off, your schedule, your vacation time, and positions like such as like airplane types and captain FO, relief pilot positions. So right now I'm getting fairly senior as a first officer on the A320 in Vancouver. So that means I get a bit more power over my schedule. So if I want, you know, weekends off, I'm starting to be able to get weekends off, or if I want certain holidays off, I might be able to get them off, which makes a big difference. So if I was to go captain right away, I'd be at the bottom, and then I would be on reserve. So you're on call, and commuting to be on call is terrible. And then you'd be working every weekend, every holiday, and you'd be doing not so great flying. So it's, I think I want to ride it out for a couple of years and as a first officer. And plus I've only flown jets for 3.5 years, almost 4 years. So I kind of like to, you know, soak up a bit more experience from the captains that I fly with and see a few more airports. You know, we fly all over the continent, and so I want to experience a lot of that with guys that have done it for, you know, decades. So, you know, soak up a lot of that before I, you know, go captain, and it goes by fast. But yeah, lifestyle is definitely a thing to think about. Too many people just keep chasing the airplane, and then, you know, they have no, you know, not much time off work. So kind of want to, you know, enjoy my time off work too, because everything's just been go, go, go since I started flying, really, you know, whether it was, you know, paying for flying and then working the ramp and cargo and being junior at Jazz and as an FO, then finally getting, you know, senior enough just to go captain, now being junior captain, and then going to Air Canada being junior. So, you know, after so many years, it's nice just to, you know, finally be senior and enjoy, you know, life outside of work too. It counts for a lot.
Yeah, 100%. That makes sense. Could you touch on like your schedule, like what that looks like month to month, or has that like evolved over time? And then you got kind of to build your own.
My schedule's gotten quite a bit better. They're called pairings. So when you go to work, it's called a pairing. So whether it's a single day pairing or a 4 day pairing, and anything in between, you can bid on those, and the company provides, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4 days, as we call them. But since I commute, I try to bid for 4 day pairings. So that way I can commute over to Vancouver, do my work over 4 days. And when you're away, they keep you in a hotel. So, you know, when I'm in Vancouver, I'm expected to be at my base. So the company doesn't provide a hotel or anything like that. So 4 days are my, you know, the easiest option for me. So like I'll make my way to Vancouver, and now I'm getting senior enough to bid for 4 day pairings that start later, so I can actually leave the Victoria the day of my pairing, and rather than going over the night before and, you know, spending a night in a crash pad, they're called, or a hotel, on my own expense. So that's really nice. So I'll do like 4 days on, and then maybe have like 4 days off, and maybe do another 4 days on, maybe have like 5 days off. We work a maximum of 16 days a month on the narrow body fleet. So, and it's all, they kind of make it complicated, but, every month they set out how many hours the pilot's going to work in the month. So some month it'll be 80, it could be 82, it could be 78, it could be something. So these pairings are all built, you know, with how, and they're worth so many hours. So, you might end up actually being able to do pairings that have a higher amount of hours and only work maybe like 14 days or 12 days. But right now I'm just working 16 days, you know, or flying's not too productive on the Airbus, but as they call it, productive is like, you know, the more you fly per day, the more hours you do, so the less days you may have to work in the month. It's kind of a complicated system, but
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, no, that's cool.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. So it's been good. So I, you know, usually have a month where I have maybe almost a week off during a month, and, you know, usually I get like maybe 3 or 4 days off in between. So it's not too bad at all. Yeah. I'm quite enjoying the schedule now.
Yeah. That's awesome. Nice. I guess being able to fly all around North America, do you have a favorite, like overnighter, like favorite place you visited or something?
I think, I haven't been there for a while, but St. John's is really cool. Like out in Newfoundland, it's quite a ways to go, you know, for time zones and whatnot, but, such a different and neat town. And I quite enjoyed Halifax as well, but, the A320 has been mostly doing, domestic Canada flying, such as that. The 737 MAX and the C series are doing a lot of the US and Mexico flying, but I think the favorite place I probably overnighted, on the Airbus was Los Angeles. Although a couple nights ago I laid over in Vegas, so that was pretty fun. So
do you have like any funny overnight stories? I know like a couple of pilots have talked to you, they've had some pretty stuff happen on the overnights or just nights out, stuff like that.
Yeah we've you know, if we've got a nice long layover, you know, like 25 hours or so. Like my last layover was in Vegas for 25 hours, so the captain and I, you know, we, you know, went out for dinner, then went to the casinos, you know, until quite early in the morning. So that was fun. But, you know, you got 25 hours. So it's, you know, you got lots of time to, you know, enjoy it. And it's nice when you actually get a decent layover to have fun. A lot of our normal layovers are just usually 14, 16 hours lately. So haven't been able to do much. But one of the fun things we did, too, is I had a Mexico City layover a couple of years ago. And we went to, we took an Uber and then a bus to the pyramids out there. I think it was called the Pyramid of the Sun, and, or maybe it was the Pyramid. Yeah, I think it was the Pyramid of the Sun. And, that was amazing to see. Like you could climb to the top of it and just these old ancient ruins. And yeah, that was a very memorable one.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome. Was the Airbus, originally what you were hoping for, or were you happy or looking for the Max or RJ or something like that?
Yeah, that was the one I wanted. But when I first started, I would have been happy with the 737 MAX. They weren't grounded at the time, so but that would have been the easiest way to get to Vancouver. 320, we always thought at the time was a dying fleet. They called it because they were replacing, you know, a lot of the older ones with the 737s and the C series and or the A220 as they call it now. But the 320 was the one I always wanted to fly. So I was very fortunate enough that I got onto it and. Yeah, I think I'm going to stay on it as, you know, for a while now. It's it seems to be the airplane to be on, especially now that we've ordered those A321 XLRs. So we'll potentially be doing Hawaii's and, you know, transatlantic stuff too, which would be pretty exciting.
Is that something that you like, kind of like the end goal for you too? Do you want to do like the transatlantic stuff, or are you just like really enjoying just the continental flights like around North America?
Yeah, I think I'd probably... just like the continental stuff. Yeah. The transatlantic stuff is intriguing because you get to get paid to go to, you know, to see the world pretty much. But I know that it can be very fatiguing when you're flying in the middle of the night all the time and all the time zones. And sometimes you might only have like 25 hour layovers or 28 or 48, you know, like they're not too long to really go out and explore anymore. But, you know, I might try it one day. It's kind of tempting to just give it a go and see, because, you know, I got some friends on the wide body and they, you know, they're just going to London for dinner pretty much, and or they're hanging out at the beach in Sydney, Australia. So that's a bit nicer than what I've been doing lately, you know. Flying to Winnipeg and Edmonton and Toronto in the winter is not the most glamorous, and but it'd be nice to go somewhere warm. Yeah,
no, for sure, that makes sense. I guess throughout your career, was there ever a time when you think or you considered maybe not doing the airlines, like working for a charter company of some type or doing something else?
Yeah, I was always open to the charter thing when I was at Sunwest, because Sunwest also, they didn't just have like turboprops, they also had quite the fleet of private jets. They had Lear 35s, 45s, 55s, Challenger 300, 604, Falcon 900, and Dash 8s as well. So they had quite a mix. So I was always open to the corporate lifestyle. You know, they get to do some pretty cool things, but the only downside of corporate versus airline is airlines have like quite a, you know, like you get a schedule that's more or less set in stone in a way. Corporate, you're pretty flexible. You're kind of always on call. You never know how long you're going to be away, depending who you're with. You know, there's so many variables depending on which company you're at in the corporate world. But, you know, you could be away for a week. It could be away for a day. You know, you never really know where you're going, and you're kind of on call a lot more. But at the airlines, you know, you get your schedule once a month, and that's pretty much what you fly. You know, sometimes they have to amend it to, you know, if there's a, you know, you know, something happens or what, but, you know, generally what you fly is what you fly. The downside to, you know, airlines is seniority. So when things are pretty slow, like in a downturn or something, you might get stuck at the bottom and not have a great schedule and maybe not be living where you want to for a while. But right now things are moving so fast that, you know, you get hired in an airline and you could get pretty senior fairly quick. And, which is a big bonus. Once you're senior enough, you know, you have so much more control over your life, really. So that's a big benefit of airlines. But I did think about, you know, it'd be kind of cool to stay at Sunwest and fly a Learjet or something like that. And cause they do like a lot of like, you know, like private jets, you know, in Canada always seem to go down to like Palm Springs or Scottsdale or something like that, which isn't too bad in the winter. And, you know, I know some that have, you know, flown to Europe for a few days, or there's some corporate companies out there too, you know, like someone will charter a jet and you'll fly down to Mexico or Hawaii, and the pilots will stay at the resort as well. And you just get like a week off paid vacation, really. So that's pretty tempting, but doesn't happen so much at the airlines. You know, we'll get maybe like a 20-hour Cancun or something. But it's definitely open to it. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, that might be a good thing. But I quite like the airline schedule. It really works for me. So, yeah, I think that's where I'm happy to stay at.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know that's something I'm really interested in doing kind of when I'm younger, is the charter company, because exactly what you just said, like all the cool destinations you get to visit, and then that lifestyle, like the idea of flying those smaller, fast jets and stuff. I think it's really interesting. But I think that's a pretty common opinion on it as well, though, right? It's like the time off and stuff, especially if you're getting older and stuff, you want to start a family. It's not the most convenient thing, not knowing when you're going to be around and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Another question I really wanted to ask you was about, I know you've had the opportunity to fly on the NHL teams. So I was interested how you got chosen for that, or how you even get in the cockpit and get involved in that. It's super interesting. So I'm really curious about that.
Sure. Yeah. One of the big benefits of flying the A320 for Air Canada is the A320 and the A319 are part of the Air Canada Jets fleet. So the Jets is our charter division. Sometimes companies will, whoever charters will take a 737 or something, but the Jets airplanes are specially configured for all business class seating. I was just lucky enough that my last pairing was an NHL charter for 4 days with the 25-hour layover in Vegas and 31-hour layover in Denver. So we, it was just part of my normal schedule. So it's, and I hadn't done one for about a year, but they just pop up if you're an A320 pilot sometimes, or you can bid for them. When the schedules come out, you know, they show all the pairings available, and a lot of them are Jets charters during this season with the NHL. So Air Canada's fortunate enough to be flying every Canadian NHL team, and I think a few in the States as well. So Jets is very busy lately with that. So this last pairing just popped up in my schedule, and it was a nice break from the routine. We picked up a team in Vancouver and flew the team to Denver, dropped them off there, and then we ferried an airplane empty to Vegas and had a 25-hour layover in Vegas and picked up another team and flew them to Los Angeles and then ferried an airplane empty to Denver, where we spent a 31-hour layover in Denver, and then deadheaded home. And deadhead is just when you fly as a passenger on a regular commercial flight. So it was a nice break-in routine, you know, you're flying out of usually fixed base operators like FBOs, like with all the corporate jets. So it is like a little taste of the corporate world in a way. So they are excited to do, and it's nice to break from routine where, you know, your client shows up and then you go, you get everything ready, wait for the client shows up and off you go, rather than when you're doing a sched flight with the airlines, you got your set departure time and, you're trying to get the people on and settled and then go for your on-time departure and terminal to terminal. So, that's definitely a big, exciting, thing that we do. So yeah, I quite doing those or quite enjoy doing those, whenever they pop up.
Is that offered to like anyone that's a typewriter on the Airbus? That's something anyone could bid for, or is that restricted to certain people with a certain amount of experience? Like, how do you get into the, is the charter division available to all pilots? Is that something you have to kind of work your way into?
Yes, it's available to all pilots, like on the type. So yeah, every Airbus pilot can bid for the jets flying if they pop up in the schedule, or if you're on call too. A lot of the time, more junior pilots who are sitting on reserve, they'll get called in to do a charter that's popped up or something like that. And so yeah, it's available to every pilot, but the flight attendants, they are specifically selected for jets. Like, they also fly the line as well. Like, they fly regular sched flights as well, but the ones that do the jets flying there, they're specially trained and pretty much recruited for it, and they do a fantastic job. They're very, very knowledgeable. Their service is top notch and friendly, and that's a big benefit of, or one thing I really enjoy about working the jets flights is, the flight attendants, are great to work with too. You always have a nice time because there's three of them usually, so there's five of us on board, the captain, first officer, and three flight attendants, and the crew just works. It seems like, we always work well together, and it just makes it more enjoyable. Everybody's happy and everybody's, good at their job. And, everybody in the whole company really is good at their job anyways, but it just seems like jets, is extra special, like, it's just, yeah, it's hard to describe. It's just fun.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to describe like the first experience kind of finding out that you had the opportunity to do that? Was that something, your father had told you about, or something that was available back then, or is that kind of a newer thing that Air Canada's introduced?
Air Canada's done a while, but so I knew it was around. But the first time I did a jets charter was also an NHL. It was an NHL charter, and I was on reserve, so I didn't know it was coming. So I just got called in, and they said, "Yeah, you're doing a jets today, and you're." I can't remember where I was going, but I was pretty nervous though too, because it's a bit of a different operation. You're not at the terminal usually, you're at an FBO, and you got different pickup times, and it's just a different kind of flow of events. So and you obviously want to do a really good job too, because it's not cheap to charter an A320. So and we want to do a very good job for we always want to do a good job for our regular passengers too, but jets is quite a step up with the service and all that. So it was a bit nerve-wracking, but like most things, you get pretty nervous for something and then you start doing it and it's fine. So
yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think we're getting close to an hour now, so I'm going to just do a couple like rapid fire questions for you.
Sure.
And then we'll wrap it up. So I mean, this might be tough for you. I'm not sure how many of you've flown, but can you name like all the aircraft you have flown, and of those, what is your favorite? Could be anything. Sure. General aviation. Yeah,
okay, I've flown a Cessna 150, 172, Beech Baron, Beech Bonanza, Navajo, Dash 8, 100, 300, 400, Metro 2, Metro 23, and Airbus 319, 320, 321. And I'd have to say my favorite, some people are kind of surprised by this, but the Dash 8 300 is my favorite. It's just, the 400 was fun. Like, it's twice, it's like 100 knots faster and it's got tons of power, but the 300 just was solid. It always gets you home and it hand flies beautifully, and And it's just built solid. And plus, you know, I got that kind of special place in my heart for it with the family, you know, aspect of it. My dad flew Dash 8s for years, and my mom worked on them. My uncle worked on them, and or he flew them. And yeah, it's just, yeah, it's the one airplane, you know, if I could go back and revisit anything, it would be that one. Like, I just had such a good time. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that the, I mean, those Dash 8s, I imagine there's a little bit more hand flying involved than flying the jets. Is that something that you miss? Do you kind of enjoy doing the hand flying, or do you like the ease of just kind of letting the plane do most of the work?
Yeah, I love the hand flying. Yeah. The Dash 8s were great because we would fly in a lot of, you know, smaller airports and mountainous airports. And so we'd always like, we'd often, you know, cancel IFR through 12,500 feet if it was a nice day and visually bring it in and hand bomb it in. But on the A320, I also hand fly it a lot too. It's fly by wire and all that. But, if it's not busy, like if I'm departing Edmonton or Vancouver and it's, you know, not that busy and, you know, I'll hand fly it often up to 20,000 feet and then coming into land, you know, I'll often have the autopilot off early and sometimes the auto thrust off early and just hand fly the thing. Actually going into Vegas a couple days ago, they needed us to sidestep. So that's when you're lined up for one runway and they want you to sidestep and land on the parallel runway. So we just turn the autopilot off, flight director off, everything off, and just, you know, hand flew it over and landed visually. And I love that too. And we've even done that.
That's so cool.
320. Yeah. Like, yeah. And one time we were flying the 320 from Vancouver to Kelowna and yeah, it's beautiful, clear sky day. And we just cancel IFR through 12.5 like we would in the Dash 8 and turn the autopilot, flight director, everything off and just hand flew it down the valley and landed and on runway 34. And it's just, so I still get a bit of my fill, but not as much as he did on the dashes. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. do you have a favorite airport that you visited like throughout your career? It could be, working for the airlines or just general aviation, just flying into smaller airports.
I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. Like there's, I know one that I don't like, and that's LaGuardia, but that was just... it's just
no, that was my busy. Next question. What was your favorite? So, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. So, favorite. I don't know. They're all kind of got their unique aspects to it, but I did really enjoy going to Castlegar on a nice day. Like, it was pure sunny day, and we're coming down the valley, and visually, and landing there was always a treat. It's hard to go wrong with the, you know, the mountain flying in BC. That's always pretty stunning. So yeah, I'd probably say that. And San Francisco is a really fun airport to go into, especially coming in from the north. And you're landing west, you just, they keep you high and then you just have to chop and drop, they say. And, you know, they give you a nice low altitude and a visual and you just go to idle and put the spoilers out and just drop it and come in nice and visually. And it's a lot of fun. That one's sporty too, so. I like that one as well. Yeah.
I like that answer. The San Francisco, that's like a parallel. They have parallel runways there, right? So you're doing parallel landings?
They do. Yeah.
Is that like one of the first times that you experienced that? Like landing in San Francisco? Yeah. Or had you done that previously? Yeah.
That was the first time I was on the Airbus, and I was probably pretty new on it too, but it's nerve-wracking, like any big US airport. Like they talk very fast. There's a lot of traffic and, but it is pretty cool because you're coming in on a parallel runway and there could be a 747 right beside you and you're staggered, of course. Exactly. So they, yeah, but it's really, really cool. And then you just got to be on top of your game too, you know, to keep an eye on them. And then when you land, you know, you got to make sure that you exit the runway, but not cross the other runway. And so it's definitely a bigger or a quicker pace of things. And than like airports like in Canada, so except for Toronto.
Yeah, I have heard that though. I remember my last guest on said that like the communication and stuff, like if you're comparing it to Vancouver, it's almost like tenfold. Like say you're flying into Los Angeles or something like that, like everyone's just super quick. And last guest was saying it's like almost like it wasn't English, like we're just super, super fluent. Did you find that was difficult to get used to, like your first time in and out of there, or what was that?
It was
like,
yeah. It was a little bit because you're kind of like overthinking things a bit too, because, you know, they always hype you up that the, especially in like LaGuardia, because they'll tell you like the controllers will like yell at you if you make a mistake. So you're always kind of like nervous that you're going to say the wrong thing. You might be overthinking something, but yeah, once you kind of get used to it after a while, it just becomes second nature. But like going into Chicago, like it's easy to land in Chicago. The hardest part is taxiing around because there's so many taxiways and they just, spew it off like, you know, like you've been there forever, and you might, it might just be your first time and you're trying to like figure it all out, and then they'll like kind of make some quip at you and you're like, it's my first day, like come on, be easy on me. But they even have what's called a penalty box in Chicago, so they'll put you in the penalty box usually if you're waiting for a gate, but it's actually labeled penalty box on the chart, so we always joke about being sent to the penalty box. Yeah,
that's hilarious. Awesome. If you had to name a particular flight throughout your career, could be from your discovery flight up until your most recent flight, what would you say that flight would be? And can you explain why it was so memorable?
Yeah, it's a hard one too. It's been a lot of good ones. There was one really memorable flight too. I got to take my dad up in the Metro too. It was a cargo run, so you know, we had like two passenger seats in the airplane as well. So I got to fly him from Calgary to Edmonton and back to Calgary as well. And so I got to, you know, show him the airplane I was flying and what I was doing. And yeah, that was pretty neat. And, you know, I hope it didn't scare him too much, you know, being in the Metro too. But that was really memorable. Another one was great too, is flew a Q400 up to Yellowknife and back from Calgary with a pilot named Andre. And he's one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. Great, great guy, great pilot. And he was my mom's flight instructor when my mom did her private license back in like 1980. So that was kind of neat. And we ended up just having such a, you know, just such a nice flight. You know, the weather was perfect and, you know, went, you know, there and back, and, you know, just everything just went so smoothly and nice, and working with great people too. And you know, that makes a huge difference. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Well, that's really interesting that your mom also has her private license. Have you guys done any like general aviation flights somewhere or something like that? Like, I feel like that's a pretty unique scenario. I don't know most people or many people that parents have a private pilot's license. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, she hasn't flown for years and years, but yeah, we never unfortunately did really many general aviation stuff. The most we did, I guess, was when I was doing my build up time, and you know, I'd take my parents up flying and in the 172, and we go to like Chilliwack for pie or something like that. But I remember it was a little intimidating, you know, taking both my parents up flying for like the first time together, because, you know, there's two pilots that had way more experience than I did too, who know exactly what's going on. And, if I made a little mistake or something, you know, they know. So it's a bit intimidating, yeah. But, you know, they're easy going. So.
All right, Graham, welcome back. Thanks for doing this again. I appreciate you coming back and redoing this one little segment. But so the question I was going to finish with was, this is the Aspiring Pilot podcast, where pilots come to learn, be entertained, and find inspiration. Can you provide some information or valuable advice to all the listeners who are working towards their dream aviation position right now?
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, it takes a lot of hard work. It's a lot of dedication, and, you know, it's expensive to do your flight training. So, the advice I could offer is like, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be tough. You know, there's going to be days that you're going to, you know, wonder why you're doing this, like whether it's when you're doing your commercial written or your INRAT or even doing the IFR. Like, I found the IFR was, you know, quite tricky and, you know, struggled with that a little bit. But just hang in there and keep at it. You know, you'll have a lot of good flights, but you'll have some bad flights where, yeah, you question it, but, you know, you just hit the books and keep at her and, stick with it. Cause it's a pretty good career. And, one of the other things I want to add too is like, a lot of pilots, you know, the traditional way is, you know, you finish your licenses and you go work the ramp or instruct at a chart or yeah, work the ramp at a charter company if you don't instruct, and then kind of work your way at the ladder, flying the smaller airplanes, doing cargo or charters or whatever. But a lot of people will go through the aviation colleges now too, where you can go direct to JAS, and that's great for getting a seniority number and everything, and which helps out your career long term too. But you know, I'd still recommend to give it a good thought, you know, to do the traditional route. You know, go to the charter companies, fly floats, fly, you know, skis, or fly cargo in a Navajo or a, you know, Cessna 421, and or charters, you know, on King Air and Beach 1900 Metro, you know, because those are the times where, you know, you build a solid foundation of experience. Like, you're flying in sometimes some pretty nasty conditions, uncontrolled airports. You're doing random things. Like, I have a friend that got chased by a polar bear in Churchill once, and you know, you get like a lot of random little experiences and stories like that too. And I think it's very valuable, because a lot of things that you experience, that you do, and the people you meet, you know, you carry forward to later on in your career, right? A lot of things like getting chased by a polar bear, or you know, icing up in a Navajo flying over the mountains to Cranbrook where your airspeed keeps dropping, or you know, loading bags in your own airplane, and you know just basic airmanship, such as like when we flew the Navajo, we had to clean them after every flight. You know, you're tenting the engines in the cold to make sure they're staying warm. Just things that, you know, you're looking after the airplane. We're at the airlines, you know, you've signed the logbook and walk away. So it teaches you, it gives you a really good foundation for airmanship and just the grand scheme of things. So I'd highly recommend doing that. Plus the people you meet, the stories you make, you know, are so valuable. And there'll be one day where, you know, you will be in that airliner nonetheless, and you'll, you know, be sent down up front with a, you know, a captain you haven't flown with before, and you're doing the usual, you know, I kind of think of it as like a first date, you know, you're trying to figure each other out, right? You know, like where, you know, where you're from, you know, what kind of person you're working with. And, you know, the inevitable question always comes up, you know, where were you at before Jazz, or where were you at before Air Canada? And then, you know, a lot of people like say, well, I just came from college, and, you know, the conversation kind of usually ends there. But, you know, someone will be like, yeah, I flew a Metro for Sunwest. And then your buddy there will be like, oh, I flew a Metro for Perimeter. And then they kind of have this camaraderie, or this just shared experience, and, you know, maybe a more level of trust that you've kind of got a similar background, or, you know, you shared similar experiences. And plus the people you've met along the way, aviation is such a small world that, you know, you might be like, yeah, I flew for Sunwest, and this happened to me a couple months ago. I was flying with a fairly senior captain there too. And he's like, oh, where were you at before? And I'm like, oh, Sunwest in Calgary. He's like, oh, I worked for Sunwest, but like 25 years ago. He's like, do you know so-and-so? I'm like, oh yeah, so-and-so was flying the Falcon when I was there. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember him when we flying this. And you know, it's kind of neat when things like that happen. So I definitely give it a, you know, definitely give it a good thought, you know, to do that traditional route as well. And the experience is so valuable, and just the stories are nice to have.
Yeah. That makes sense for sure. Would you say that, I don't know, from my perspective, that kind of makes sense, that if you went through and you did all these like ramp positions, or started at not even the ramp positions, more so just like those charter flights, kind of like low hours when you're doing like half ramp, half charter flights and stuff, that's those connections are stuff you can go back to too, if it ever came to like you losing your job because of something, right, through a bigger airline, maybe is opportunity to go backwards, get employed through like something else again. Would you say that's true?
Yep. Yeah, I would definitely say that's true. I know during COVID too, there's a lot of people I worked with at the airlines that went back to, you know, their jobs before, whether it was North Caribou Air or, many of the other operators there too, because, you know, if, you know, you leave on good terms, and then, you know, you always have a, you know, place to fall back on, or even if you just don't like the airline lifestyle, you can always go back. And you know, some companies, they'll always want to hire guys with King Air time or 1900 time or something. So if, you know, you get laid off from the airlines, and then the job market kind of shrinks again too, and now there's a company looking for King Air captains, and you got all this King Air time already, boom, you can hopefully, you know, slide in there too. So that definitely helps as a good backup as well, for sure.
Yeah, it's something to consider, I guess, 100%. And then before I let you go, I got to ask you about the polar bear story. So what happened there? Was he just like... You gotta take me through that. I gotta hear more.
Yeah, I wish he was here to tell you though. But he, from what I can remember, I think he parked the plane in Churchill, and he put the plane to bed and was walking to the hangar, and noticed there was a polar bear there, and the polar bear started moving towards him. So he ran, because the hangar was so close, so he ran to the hangar, and then luckily made it into the hangar before the polar bear came in. But that would be quite a scary moment. But just one of those northern experiences that you wouldn't get if you're flying for, you know, Air Canada, right? We don't get chased by polar bears very often in Toronto.
That's so funny that you said that too, because I was just watching videos last night on like polar bear attacks and stuff. So when you said that, I'm like, of course, it's like so ironic. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just one of those, yeah, really good stories that people have told me that have kind of stuck, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's definitely a standout story. 100%. Well, thanks, Graham. I appreciate you coming back on and redoing this last little segment here. And yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Oh, no worries. Yeah, happy to. Thanks very much for having me.
Of course. Yeah, anytime. All right. Take care.
All right, thanks, you two.
All right, everyone, it's Hayden. Thanks for tuning into today's episode. Hope you enjoyed the content. If you haven't already, make sure to download this episode and rate the show. You can also support myself and the show through the support link below the episode's description. Once again, as always, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now.